You know that thing you hand in these.
Okay.
Depends if you want to move anything, because we're missing one of our members.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Rules to order, and we will start with a public hearing on SCR 205.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 205 recognizes and celebrates Dr. Joe Robertson for his career at Oregon Health and Science University and extends well wishes to him upon his retirement. The measure has no expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
And we are joined by the Honorable Senator Peter Courtney.
Does that mean I come up here?
Yes, it does.
Yes.
I just want to point out, twice in a row we've done live people now.
They're getting into this habit of doing live people.
I'm hoping things don't go south on them.
Senator Witter said I misspoke. I should have said ornery instead of honorable.
So my name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator, and I represent the District 11. This is major portions of Salem and up through Jervis and Woodburn. And I've come here today to support this measure, which I actually introduced. I'm not going to read a statement because I don't have a statement. And I'm not going to share all the things in front of me because I'd rather do that on the floor of the Senate should this bill go out to the floor of the Senate and should the chair ask me to present. Now, this is a very frightening moment for me because this is a very unfriendly committee. The chair thinks that she is not me. That senator, he hates me. That senator wants to be me. I just had a fight with that senator in her office. And this senator, I don't trust. So I understand the.
He's got it right, Madam Chair.
This committee.
Josh is a good guy.
Let me.
Josh is a good guy.
Yeah, I offered him a job and he rejected it. I offered him on
that's
a
oh, interesting.
A week later, he's with Przanski, so don't bring up this guy. I'm not, he's another piece of work. He made a mistake there. Josh is going to turn me down.
Oh, okay.
Demonstrated he's a very bright young man. We're glad to have him.
This is to honor Joseph Edmund Robertson, Jr., who is the president of the Oregon Health Science University. He's retiring. And all I'm going to say, I'm going to only talk about a few things about his past that I think are interesting. I'm not going to go into depth. I'm just not. I'll wait and see if you think this is a good idea or not. And there's people in the audience, I believe, that could go into that. I do know that he comes from the state of Indiana. A lot of people don't realize that. And he doesn't come from Indianapolis. Everybody thinks if you live in Indiana, you live in Indianapolis. He comes from Brownstone. Have no idea where that is. Wife is Patricia. I've met her. Very nice person. He has a son, CJ, who is graduated from the University of Oregon, has a master's degree in public health from San Diego State, his son does, and I believe his son lived in the San Diego area, if not, I think in Los Angeles, sir, I'm pretty sure. His late daughter, Katie, graduated from Dartmouth, which is significant for me. My brother has, older brother has 2 degrees from Dartmouth, a former governor, John Kitzhaber. It's a very good school, comes from Dartmouth. So that's the family. He's interesting. He goes to Yale, where he played basketball. And he comes from a part of the country that is very much involved in sports. And he and I have actually labored over a bill that we just passed yesterday on the floor unanimously on concussions. And as a result of a conversation I've had with him, I think if I'm still alive and I make it, I'll introduce a bill in 2019 on concussions that he's going to help me with, because he loves contact sports as much as I do, but we're both struggling with that whole world about how much damage we're doing to the human brain of very young people who rely on us to look out for them, a speech I gave yesterday which got nowhere. So his degree in medicine comes from Indiana University after he graduates from Yale. He would go on, and I'll jump here. He got a master's degree, I didn't know that, from the University of Oregon. And I think that was the result of his wanting to go into hospital administration, even though he had started at the Oregon Health Science University, where his residency was. I think the residency, an ophthalmologist, he's an ophthalmologist at the Oregon Health Science University, is the reason he came to Oregon. I don't think he would have been here, though, but he came here, and he fell in love with it. What's fascinating about him is he's going to become the president starting in 2006. He's homegrown because very seldom do you see the president of a major medical facility that starts out as a resident and then becomes an online physician. He became the dean of the School of Medicine there at Darnold Health. I did not know that. And then he became the president. So he's come all the way up, because I know the one they're going to hire replace him is going to come from some East Coast thing. Yeah. Like, you know, if you don't come from outside, you're not any good. So don't get me into that. So he was really with from within. And they struck gold, I think, when they got this person. And, you know, I know him more personally almost as much as I do a physician. And he... You know, I've heard about the Knight Center, but what you haven't heard, you know this tuition program we have that if a doctor-to-be or a dentist or a nurse, a physician assistant, among other, say they'll serve 5 years in an underserved area after they graduate from their medical school, they will get free tuition. You know, we support that every year. To, that all came from him, so I could go on and on about him as a person. I'm not going to get a lot of personal things. I'd rather let that wait. But I didn't know this, that in a high school tournament, I love this, he beat Fuzzy Zeller, who later went on to win both the Masters and the U.S. Open. Now, it's a little known fact, but it does tell you that probably Dr. Robertson is a natural-born athlete, a very good athlete, a very, very good athlete, because we think only the very good athletes play professional sports. But there are men and women that were very good athletes, and they don't talk about it, and I think this is exactly what we have here. Another cute thing, and then I'll be still, John Cougar Mellencamp, who grew up in Seymour, Indiana, played at all the high school dances in Brownstown. So, I don't know if you know who that is. I don't know who it is.
It's a great guitar player.
Okay, so you know who it is.
12-string guitar.
He played at his high school dances. Little known fact. I know that Senator Jackie Winters doesn't know who that is. But I have that down here.
I have a musician at home that's a guitarist.
So you know about this. So anyway, so I'm just telling you that he has these intriguing things about his back. I think the saddest thing about this resolution is that I had to create it. Because he's been there, what, 10, 11 years? I wish he'd be there another 10, 11. And I really don't think they're going to replace him. You say, oh, I'll cut it out. No, I'm not sure you're going to replace this guy. I'm not sure you're going to. He has that ability. You know, he was doing the eye operation that was done on me by the doctor that takes care of him down in Eugene before that doctor was even. He was the first in the nation in this state to do the kind of eye operation done to me in September because I got a messed up eye. And he was doing that, and the only one doing it until he went into administration, and because it's such a delicate eye operation, he still sees patients. Even as president, he was still seeing patients. I know you don't believe that, but he was still seeing patients. And so he's very much patient-oriented, and I don't just say that because it sounds good. Because after the surgery, I happened to be with him, and I was scared that he described everything that was done to me and everything and assured me he thought I would be fine. So I think he's a remarkable person. He's had a lot of tragedies in life, a lot of suffering, and people who suffer get to me. I won't deny it. He has suffered too much. He's a great administrator, great hospital administrator, great doctor, great Oregonian. I'm not happy he's no longer going to be the president. We're going to miss him. Oh, yes, you are. I think the Oregon Health Science University is as good as anything on the West Coast and one of the best in the nation. And so we're going to put this on the floor if you want to. You don't want to. That's up to you to say how we feel about him. So I thank you for letting me talk like this. I'll be a little more structured later on if the moment comes to me. But I touched on each one of his areas that I think make him important.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. President, just because I know you want to know, Brownsville is in the southern part of Indiana, sort of south
Browns
central.
What?
Brownstone? Brownstone.
You said Brownsville.
I said it wrong. It's Brownstone, the one you mentioned, where he was born. It's a little town, a little less than 3,000 people, and they also call it B-Town. Locally.
Well, Chair.
It's county seat of Jackson County.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, you don't know where it is because you come from Nebraska. You think you're talking about a town in Nebraska. You have no idea what you're talking about.
But this one does.
Oh. You know what? That I don't like.
Just because I know you like to know these things.
No, I do. I did know he came from a small town. Very much of it. You know, you think Indianapolis, he is not, he's from a very small town.
Oh, who's here? Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. President.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, we have no one else signed up, so we will close the public hearing on SCR 205 and open a work session on SCR 205. Senator Winters.
Okay. SCR, oh, Madam Chair, I move. Wait a minute, I've lost my place here in this thing. I move SCR 205 to the full floor with a...
Be adopted,
recommended, do pass, and all those wonderful things that we do to get it to the floor.
To sanitize this, Senator Winters moves SCR 205 to the Senate floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Great. So ordered, and we will ask Senator Courtney to carry this.
How do you object, actually, to an individual who has devoted and given so much services to citizens of the state of Oregon? Honey.
I noticed that no one did.
Thank you.
By voting no.
Okay, now.
Is there a record for this one? Do we get something? We can reopen this and all vote no just to irritate the president and prove him right?
No, we will not give
you
that
opportunity. It'll guarantee you never have to get a job application for a year.
And now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1510. Committee, we had a hearing on this bill. It's basically a technical bill with some changes proposed by the Secretary of State. And we also have four amendments to this. We have an amendment, the Dash 7 amendment, with four pieces to it that we've distributed to the committee. So I thought we would start with Josh summarizing the amendments, and then we can have some discussion. We don't have the paperwork to move it today, and I understand there are some concerns about it, so we'll just figure out what those are and where we want to go from here. So, Josh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Dash 7 amendments, it's available on OLIS for your consideration. It does a number of different things. The amendment caps at 2,000 the number of signatures that may be included on a prospective petition to initiate a state measure. The amendment clarifies the obligation of the Secretary of State to include the final certified ballot title on the cover and signature sheets of an initiative petition. Requires an elector who signs an electronic signature sheet for a petition or prospective petition to have personally printed the sheet. It classifies specifically identified voter-related information as public records subject to disclosure and directs the Secretary of State to maintain and update a list of voters who have and have not voted and during the election period make that list available each business day. There's a few more minor technical fixes that are included in the amendments. It provides petition and petition committees and political committees with the one-day grace period following the filing of a statement of organization to amend that statement to include financial account information. It eliminates the obligation of the district election officer to notify the county clerk whether a candidate elected to district office is qualified to hold the office, and it modifies the existing statute applicable to a filing officer's determination that a candidate has died, withdrawn, or is not qualified to hold office. It directs the filing officer to reprint ballots rather than erase or cancel them. It moves the obligation to do so from the 47th day before an election to the 50th day before an election. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1510 with the Dash 711 has no revenue impact. We do not yet have a fiscal impact statement.
Okay. I think the controversy that we have, I suspect, is on the initiative petitions piece and on the voter privacy piece. So I'm thinking we might invite the Secretary of State's office up and Kimberly McCulloch to provide a little actual knowledge to our questions. So if you could first of all address the part of the amendment that requires that you have a final ballot title before you start to gather petitions. Committee, I think you recall the Secretary of State had a rulemaking underway to allow petitions to be signatures to be gathered before the final ballot title was published, and there was controversy on that, so they withdrew, and the Secretary of State asked for clarification. So with that, why don't you tell us where we are?
Chair, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Steve Elzinga. I'm the Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for the Secretary of State. Secretary Richardson appreciates the committee's response to his request to clarify Oregon Initiative circulation statutes. However, he is disappointed that the clarifications in the Dash 7 restrict initiative voting rights and even override the E-sheet rules of former Secretary of State and now Democrat Party of Oregon Chair Gene Atkins. Secretary Richardson's believes that it would be a better public policy to codify and expand current initiative voting rights, and specifically to the section you referred to. Secretary Richardson recommends that grassroots petitioners should be allowed to circulate petitions with the Attorney General's certified ballot title during any legal challenge, as this would empower average Oregonians by preventing powerful and wealthy special interest groups from using frivolous lawsuits to manipulate the initiative process.
Is the Secretary of State's position the signature before the ballot title, is that that it would at least have to be the certified title and that it would, it could be circulated before the Supreme Court rules? Is that what he's saying, or does he want it like the proposed ballot title to be the starting point?
The Secretary's recommendation to the committee is based on input from the Independent Party of Oregon and the League of Women Voters, and their combined recommendation was to use the Attorney General's ballot title to allow circulation during the pendency of a lawsuit.
Okay. So Kimberly, would you like to comment on that?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, yes, thank you for the opportunity. You know, from our perspective, we think that it's really important that vote. I'm so sorry about that. My name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. So from our perspective, we think it's crucially important that voters are fully aware of what it is that they're signing when they sign an initiative petition, just like they should be fully informed about what they're voting for when they go to the ballot. So the process of making sure that the ballot title is accurate and clear is really crucial to ensuring that that happens. And so, you know, from our perspective, that process needs to end so that people that are signing an initiative petition don't think they're signing, you know, one thing and turns out that they're signing another. You know, people rely on that ballot title to understand what the initiative petition does. Either, you know, they don't necessarily always understand legalese. We all know that it can be sometimes hard to understand what a law actually does. Maybe they don't have time to read it, but they assume that that information in that ballot title is accurate. And you know, we as an organization, and I myself even have engaged in the ballot title process. We think it's a process that many people should participate in, because all of those different perspectives that come to either the Attorney General through the comment process or to the Supreme Court really help the Attorney General and the Supreme Court to shape a ballot title that takes into consideration all of the different possible ways that this language could be interpreted, and also making sure that, you know, that the way that the law actually is going to function is fully reflected in that title. And so you know, we really think that it's extremely important that that process be completed before folks sign that initiative petition.
Okay. Senator Bookquist.
Madam Chair, I have two questions. The first one is for Mr. Trout, because he's older than Mr. Elsinger. I'm trying to recollect how many times, maybe off the top of your head, where we've had a ballot title challenge between the Attorney General and the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has made any major change other than a few editings to ballot titles. Do you have any recollection of how many times this happened?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, Steve Trout, State Election Director. Senator, I would hesitate to go off the top of my head. I know that there's been a couple where there's been some significant changes, but I'd be willing to go back and do the research if that would help the committee move this.
Madam Chair, that would be helpful. Now I have a question for Kimberly. Mm-hmm. What is the, I understand your intent. The question is that, you know, democracy is not equal. So anybody with rich money, like corporations will say, or other people on the other side, can challenge ballot titles and delay the entire process for the grassroots people. Of course, can't even afford to go hire a lawyer. So what protection do you see at the ACLU to protect those grassroots people that are trying to challenge big government and rich individuals who, of course, can afford to play this out in court and routinely do, as you've pointed out?
So Senator Boqvist and Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I think it's a fair point that you bring up. I think that organizations like our own actually intend to support the grassroots, and that's why we do engage in that process. My advice to folks that are filing these initiative petitions in the first place is start early, write a law that makes a lot of sense. I mean, a lot of the time where things actually get extended is because the law is unclear, it doesn't make sense. So, do your homework, do the work, get in there early, and if it doesn't work out, then you always have the opportunity to come at it again. And so I understand this concern about big money interest and so on, but what I've actually seen from my perspective is all sorts of organizations that do represent the people that engage in this process. So I understand the concern there, but I think that as an attorney, I follow an ethical code. When we submit comments and when the ACLU submits comments, we don't do it for frivolous reasons. We do it because we really want to educate the voters and make sure that they have accurate information. So if an attorney were to actually file something frivolously, they would be actually violating their ethical code, and I would hope that attorneys would take that responsibility seriously.
Well, unfortunately, Madam Chair, for a lot of reasons, I know a lot of attorneys are unethical, but give me an example here. I mean, you have the League of Oregon Women Voters and the Independent Party. Independent Party is just about as grassroots as independent as you can possibly get, because you can't figure out what they're doing most of the time. And then you have the League of Women Voters, who are on the opposite side of this issue with the ACLU. I mean, a good lobbyist, and you're a good lobbyist, should be able to articulate why are you differing from this other two organizations, which are, of course, grassroots organizations?
Senator Boqvist and Chair Burdick, I actually haven't talked to the League of Women Voters specifically about this bill and about their position, so I don't know exactly why they have arrived at a different conclusion than we have. I can just say that, we really believe that this process needs to have integrity, and we're deeply concerned about voters signing something when they think it means something different than it actually does. And from our perspective, there have been a number of times when we've been involved in this ballot title process where we believe that the ballot title that was arrived at after the challenges is much more accurate and explains things in a better way for the voters.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And if you have any, for instances, that would be helpful for the committee as
okay.
well.
I can follow up.
Other questions?
Senator to the left.
No, he was wanting to answer the question.
Oh, yes.
Sorry, just to clarify on the record, I want to make sure that the committee is aware. So the League of Women Voters has not taken a position on this amendment, to the best of my knowledge. They were involved in the drafting of the Secretary of State's administrative rule, which is what the secretary recommends that the committee codify. But I want to be very clear that I'm not speaking for them on this bill. They were involved in the drafting of the rule.
Okay. We need to do some research on where the league stands, because that would be relevant. Senator Beyer.
Just a clarification question, Mr. Trout. My memory is that we have a longstanding practice of the initiative that you had to get a certified ballot title before you could start certifying petitions. We changed that a couple of sessions ago to allow you to collect, not you, but to allow petitioners to collect a limited money amount before they could submit for that. What's the legal standing of having to do that? And what is the law now? If we were to do nothing at all, would the law remain that they have to get a ballot title before they can collect the final signatures?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm not really clear on what you're referencing, but let me tell you what the current process is today.
Good. That's
so
we're good with that.
So, someone with an idea for an initiative will come to our office and get what's called prospective petitions,
right.
So that they will go out and circulate that and gather at least 1,000 signatures and come and submit those. So that kind of that's the entry fee to get into the process.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, we will send that over to the Attorney General asking for a ballot title. And so then we'll go through the notice or the public comment periods and different timelines. Takes about a month for that process to go forward. And then at that point, the Attorney General will certify a ballot title to us. At that point, people have 10 days to appeal that to the Supreme Court. And so during all of this time, after that initial 1,000 or so is turned in, there's no petition gathering on certified sheets until the Supreme Court rules.
And 1,000 signatures was a change that was made, I don't remember when, but it's recently, it's within the last 3 or 4 years. Before that, they couldn't collect any signatures until they had a ballot title.
No. It was 25 for a prospective petition for years. But it's always been the case that you could not circulate until the ballot title. It goes through a draft ballot title, then there's comments, then the certified ballot title, and then there's an opportunity for a court decision. And it's an expedited process. And it'd be interesting to find out, if you have the answer, how long typically the Supreme Court takes, because as I understand it, and I've actually done a petition, it was a pretty short timeline for them to, it goes to the front of the line.
That's essentially been the process for 100 years.
Yes.
So Madam Chair, the normal timeline is about 3 to 4 months. It goes from about I've seen them from about 2 months to 7 months, but the average is right in the 3 to 4 month range for the Supreme Court to make a determination.
So in Kimberly's point, you know, the solution, and I
start early.
Is to start early, and then you can be sure of having a good timeline to get decisions if you wait till it's final, because it's not really final until the Supreme Court rules on it under our process. Other questions?
Oh, I just point out, we don't follow that rule of starting early.
Well, we should.
Which is why they're here and we're saying no.
All right. Are there other questions?
I just have a curiosity. I mean, the 2,000 number that's in the amendment, is that because, you know, you just don't want to overwhelm it? Is that something the Secretary of State's in it? Why did somebody come up? It says at least 1,000, but not more than 2,000. I'm just curious where that came from.
Yeah.
Do those apply to the, because I asked that same question, do those apply to the total number required to qualify? Do those apply toward the total?
They do, yes. So the current administrative rule is that you have to collect at least 1,000, but no more than 2,000 in order to start the ballot title process. The Secretary of State's initial draft of rules on this issue removed the 2,000 requirement and thus allowed unlimited to be submitted initially, but the final version of the rule that we adopted before we suspended it for the legislature's guidance was shifted away from that provision, and we're not intending to go back to that regardless of what the legislature chooses to do.
And of course, the intent of that would be that the 2,000 are without benefit of any ballot title. They're just the petitioner's concept of what, and whatever the petitioner decides to say to get those signatures.
So, Madam Chair, just one point of clarification. So for those prospective petitions, they have to have a copy of the text of the measure with them.
Correct.
So that's the balance before the ballot titles are available.
And they read it diligently before they sign. Okay, any other questions on this point? Okay, the other point that we had some questions about is voter privacy in the amendment. Could you kind of elaborate your position on that? The amendment would direct the Secretary of State to maintain and update a list of voters who have not voted for Matchback and make it available for business each day. And it, as I recall, it would also, either the amendment or the underlying bill specifies what kind of information can be released. So you want to comment on that?
Certainly, Madam Chair. The Secretary is very appreciative of the committee taking this issue up. We discovered the ambiguity in the law on this last year, and we requested that the legislature take a look at it, and we're very pleased with the draft in the 5-7, sections 20-21, and codifying this. There's a few technical issues with the way that it is currently written, and we've talked with your committee counsel and your chief of staff, Senator Burdick, about those clarifications, and we believe the intent of the committee is to ensure that a voter's birth month and birth day is not disclosed for purposes of preventing identity theft and, you know, with increases in hacking and that sort of thing. And the way it's currently written, there is some ambiguity on what is required there. And so there, a little bit of tweaking on that provision would be appreciated if the committee's intent is to protect that.
Kimberly, do you want to comment on that?
You know, I would just echo the comments. We always are concerned about people's private and personal information being being released. And so, you know, making sure that it's just the year that someone is born and not their full birth date, I think, is incredibly important for protecting people's privacy. So.
And then Senator Boquist.
You can go ahead and do the next question.
The things like Social Security number, driver's license, whatever, are also kept private. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that is correct. There is a whole list of things that are already protected in statute, and Social Security number is one of those things.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. If we're worried about security, maybe we should ban Google. So, especially as the latest reports of the last week or so coming out showing, you know, all you people who have those phones, which I don't, you know, 100% of your data is bought up by Google. So, they'll all know you were in here on this particular bill, and they'll probably even have a copy of the videotape if they're that good. But my question is sections 20 and 21. We've been issuing. Most of us here, actually, all of us here, purchased voter files during the election cycle from the Secretary of State's office. It seems to go pretty smooth. I mean, the last Republican governor, which I know was 50 years ago, was Vic Atiyah. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So what I'm trying to figure out, what are we doing here? I look at A through, just for the record, J. I do realize, you know, some of us geeks, like, you know, Mr. Trout and I have looked at a voter file, and there's probably 27 lines on there, and that's more than A through G. So, I mean, why is there a problem? What is it we're trying to fix? Is it, and what is we going to restrict based on this sort of guidance here?
So the A through J that you mentioned are a codification with one exception of our current policy. Okay. The only difference between that list and our current policy is whether the telephone number of the elector is disclosed. But the problem that needs to be fixed here is that the current statute leaves so much ambiguity that potentially the Secretary of State and the 36 county clerks could have, you know, there could be 37 different interpretations of what information on a voter list is used. And although the current secretary does not intend to change his policy, a future secretary could change the policy and disclose or decline to disclose more than what's available. And so we requested an attorney general opinion on exactly what is required to be disclosed, what is prohibited from being disclosed, and what is the gray area in the middle that is up to each of the county clerks and the secretary. And currently, most of the information is in that gray area. And so what this does is it codifies the legislature's policy preference. Instead of leaving a massive gray area, it says this is what should be disclosed. And we're pleased that everything that we currently disclose is required to be disclosed in this list, and we're supportive of that.
Okay. Kimberly, did you want to comment on that?
I don't think I have anything to add now.
All right. Other questions, comments? Okay. Senator Winters, did you have concerns on other aspects of this?
No, not other than have been already discussed, and I think it poses enough concerns, and from what we heard, that you know, I think it gives us some pause as to what we do with the dash sevens.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Senator Beyer.
I'd like to know about the other two items.
Yes.
We had a discussion about the removing dead candidates from the ballot.
Erasing dead candidates.
Erasing, I forgot about
erasing.
Erasing dead candidates, well, that seems harder. But I wonder about that one. And when we were talking about it the last time, I thought that's a pretty expensive proposition to get in there and requiring counties to do that. That's that one. And I guess my second one on the bank accounts, I know we had a conflict in the statute. Mr. Trout talked about that before, but one-day grace period seems like a very limited time to do this. Well, it would make, I wonder, wouldn't it make more sense to give them 7 business days or 5 business days to do that? It's not that easy to get bank accounts open anymore.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I mean, we'd be open to any time frame. It's just right now.
There's none. I realize there's none.
And so this, the amendments in the Dash 7 were to bring in the other two categories that we failed to include in the original bill. So if you'd like that to be 3 days or whatever, we'd be, or 5 days, you know, we'd be open to that process. It's just right now, it's a chicken and egg situation, and it's difficult for people to get a bank account if they don't have a committee, and they can't get a committee if they don't have a bank account.
So you probably have a lot of people are in non-compliance at the start.
Where are we talking about?
We're in the amendments on page 2.
Okay.
Bold print at the top.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's actually 3 separate statutes on the bank account. There's one for political candidates and the treasurers, there's one for political committees, and there's one for petition committees. And so the original bill had just one of those. The amendments pick up the other 2.
Okay. And so telling us where.
So
where?
Section 15 is the political committees.
But how about a page?
Wait.
Okay. All right. Let me start. Let's slow down here.
We're old people here.
So let's start with page 2 of the amendments.
Oh,
page
okay.
2 of the amendments at the very top, lines 3 to 5 to give you the one-day grace period. And this is the statute applicable to chief petitioners.
Okay.
Then we jump, if we wanted to keep moving, section 5 is in the introduced bill. So that's left alone in the amendments. That's okay. Political candidates or their treasurer. And then if we jump ahead to section 15, which is on
page 5,
that's the statute applicable to political committees. And so you'll see the same language that we've talked about in the other 2 statutes on page 6, lines 13 through 15.
One day doesn't work.
So this would give everybody one day.
One day.
Fix it.
So it should be something aside, something larger than one day, but for all 3. Is there any justification? Is there any justification for having different ones for different?
Madam Chair, I would. All I would ask is that all 3 be the same.
Who would agree?
I would think 5 business days.
5 business days then gives you, covers the weekend, gives you time to do stuff, gives you the banking things.
7 calendar or 5.
It's probably easier.
Is it 5?
Probably easier to go 7 calendar days. That would. They wouldn't have to say business days.
Yeah, nobody would know the difference. You know, most people. Sole proprietorships, based on other earlier discussions today, probably work on the weekends, so they wouldn't understand that. So I agree with Senator Beyer in a bipartisan manner. 7 calendar days.
Okay.
Is that good?
Good.
All right, see? All right.
So, Madam Chair, just on that point, I think, you know, the only thing to consider when making those time changes is the transparency situation with people filing and getting that information into OraStar. So, you know, if you're willing to wait for 5 days for that to happen, or 3 days, or 20 days, or whatever, that's really what you need to evaluate when making that decision.
I mean, it's not that big a deal. At some point, they're going to have to report all the financial information on OraStar anyway. I mean, just having the bank account, really, that's not a whole lot of transparency.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I was just
bringing that to
make sure that you're considering all the practical considerations.
And after they're set up, they can adjust them. It's just saying that at the beginning, you've got X number of days to get all their stuff in.
Right. You may do it in 5.
Right. Could do it in the first day and not have to worry about it again. So.
Right. If you're
if you're coastal.
In our district, you're probably going to drive the damn bank.
Exactly.
And then the internet system won't work. And then they'll be down for maintenance. And then I'm just pointing out these things, okay? Madam Chair, I do have a question for council on page 13.
You actually.
Okay.
Of the amendment.
Which page, Senator?
Page 13.
Amendment page 13. This is the full employment for international paper clause. This is lines 5 to 8.
Line 5B.
Which helped me out, Councilor Ward. This magically came from someplace. What does it do?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there we go. So my understanding is the existing statute right above here authorizes electronic signature sheets. And what the amendment says is that if you're going to sign an electronic signature sheet as opposed to signing a paper petition, you have to be the person who printed off the electronic signature sheet.
And the rationale for that, as I understand it, is because you don't have a circulator on these sheets. You just have an individual signature. And so you don't have the same kind of accountability, like if someone is a volunteer circulator, you don't have the same kind of accountability.
This is sort of like in 99, AAA referred to transportation package, and the way they did it, they didn't do it electronically, but they sent a single petition out to each one of their members and asked them to send it in.
Right, but that
they
was...
had it marked where they had to sign it.
But
so
that
this would just do it electronically.
Yeah, but what was the difference in that and what we're talking
Changing
about?
A stamp.
Because those had to have a circulator. Those were multi-signature petitions, I think.
I think they each had to sign. I think they had to sign in two places.
Maybe they could tell us.
Yeah, could you tell us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so the way that this is currently drafted, it makes two changes. The first change is what the chair referred to on prohibiting a circulator from circulating the e-sheet, passing it out, handing it out, that sort of thing. And the second change, though, is overriding the rules implemented by former Secretary Atkins, which allowed e-sheets to be distributed through a newsletter. For example, in 2016, the OEA, in their magazine, Today's OEA, had an insert where they put it right in the middle of their magazine, collecting signatures for a better Oregon on IP28. And in this, they have the full text, which is required, and then they have a single signature e-sheet here in the magazine. And so the way that this is currently written, it would prohibit anyone from distributing an e-sheet through a magazine or a newsletter or something like that. And the secretary recommends that, we understand that we have a policy difference on the circulation aspect, but he recommends that at a minimum, the committee consider going back to codifying what Secretary Atkins had as administrative rules to allow people to circulate an e-sheet through a magazine or a newsletter like this.
Kimberly, did you have an opinion on that?
About that last change, not necessarily, but for us, I think that the key here is that the way that the process works right now, where if a person is a circulator and they're gathering petitions or they're gathering signatures, is that they have to certify that that sheet before they turn it in. And so if there's fraud or abuse or problems with the signatures, there's a way for the Elections Division to follow up with that particular circulator and try to address the issue. And so these e-sheets, although they're a really great thing for individuals to be able to use to actually be able to sign a petition on their own without having to go out and find somebody to sign their petition, if a circulator or somebody who's not, well, they're basically not a circulator, but they're essentially acting as a circulator by printing those out and getting people to sign them and turn them in, it's sort of a backdoor way of getting around those requirements. And so we would have a lot of concerns about just making sure that the folks that are actually signing these petitions are the ones who are printing them out and submitting them themselves. So, I mean, that would be our preference.
Have there been abuses of the e-signature sheets?
I can't give you specific examples of abuses, but certainly there are and there have been abuses in the past with people who have been gathering signatures, and that's the reason that we have a pretty robust set of rules around how this all happens and how they have to circulate certify the the signature sheets and so on. And so, I mean, I think that fraud and abuse in this system is actually something that we should be concerned about and make sure that we have a solid system for being able to follow up and investigate and make sure that it doesn't happen.
Senator Byer.
And I ask Mr. Trout, I believe you could, you know, like I said, AAA did this, they sent it out, and what the individual was doing, they had the standard petition, and then this would just be a different way to get it to them, but they signed both as a petitioner and as the circulator. I think they signed the form twice.
Yes, those were volunteer.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, that was, you know, allowed historically, and really that's, I think, what facilitated the e-sheets was for those single signers. This was created to be able to allow that without having to sign twice, both as the signer and as the circulator.
I see.
And I will just, you know, add that, you know, with the e-sheets, they have the highest validity rates of any of the petitions that we have as they come in. So as far as, you know, they're the cleanest petitions and have the highest validity rate.
What is that rate?
Madam Chair, it depends on what the petition is, but it's considerably higher than the others. We could gather some statistics for you on the different, you know, if there's particular petitions you'd like us to show. You know, there's some of the committees use e-sheets more than others, and so there's just a lot of variance. But historically, since the e-sheets came in, they've had the highest validity rates across all of them.
So the issue really isn't whether the person printed the form out themselves or not. The issue is whether the form is the correct form and whether the person signing it was a registered voter or not.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, at the end of the day, we're going to take that, whether it's a 10-signature sheet or an e-sheet, and compare the signature on the petition to the signature in the voter registration database. And if it matches, it counts. And if it doesn't, it doesn't.
There's really no difference between what you were showing me in that pamphlet there, the OEA, than someone who prints it out on a computer.
Well, but if you could have a situation, couldn't you, where a paid petitioner, a paid circulator, went and handed out or put these in shops or whatever, went around and gathered them up. These are paid people, and there's no way you could tell from an e-sheet whether those sheets were circulated by a paid person. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. However, there is a way that this could be drafted that gets at what you're trying to get at without stopping what Senator Byer is talking about. And historically, the way the rules were written is there was a prohibition on circulators circulating with e-sheets. And so then if anyone is seen doing that, there can be a complaint filed. But there is no way for the elections division to tell, was this sheet of paper printed out at home on someone's computer, or did someone else print it and give it to someone else? It's just, you know, there's no way they're going to know that when they receive the sheets.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
No, Madam Chair, in the spirit of bipartisanship, right, I'm not going to ask any questions, but I'll just say that this particular clause in this bill right here, the way it's written right now, is an absolute no vote. Regardless, and if we come to vote, then I will use my option to explain why I think it's a no vote. But I think it's not crafted well. It doesn't address the fraud intent that you're thinking needs to be addressed, and I don't disagree with you. I have other reasons to suspect why, you know, it's in here. Most everything else that's in here, I mean, I'm amenable to, you know, seeing how they can craft and do things to make it work, but I mean, there are two pieces in here that I see are not related to elections in my mind at all, and they're related on who has access to elections. And I,
how would you know? Printed it out.
Two of these conceptual ideas. So, I think several of these sections need some serious work to them in order to get any sort of bipartisan support and not get backlash from both sides of this particular issue.
I think the good senator, as chair, is trying to say we're not ready. There's some work that needs to be.
I thought I clarified that at the beginning.
We're telling you we might not be ready for a while on two particular issues.
Madam Chair, I mean, we're totally willing to work with you and staff to get what your intent is so that we can make sure that it's workable going down the road.
A question?
Yes, Senator Byer.
Clarify for me, what's the current practice with electronic signature sheets? Is there one?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, so when the e-sheets come in, you know, there's just one signature on them, and so it's pretty easy to distinguish them from the others. Those that are being paid are often color sheets, and so it's pretty easy to distinguish those. But it's the same process. You know, we pull the signature, look up the voter in OCVR, the voter registration database, compare the signature on the e-sheet petition with the voter registration, and if it matches, it counts.
So today, somebody can go online, print out a sheet,
yes,
sign it, and send it in?
Yes.
Have you ever seen those?
No. I don't do initiative petitions.
and Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, that was put in place by the legislature here just within the last, you know, 5 to 6 years.
Huh. Madam Chair, I think it's actually, because what I've seen, and I've seen it on both sides, I mean, so just by both sides of petition issues I've seen this on, I mean, with modern technology that, you know, this legislature seems to be pushing, at least, you know, with all of the stuff we're doing right here now, and now we got 40% more bandwidth, so we got lots of room. No more Amazon and videotapes for the lobbyists, okay? But I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Trout, is that you literally, because you cannot tell the difference, is that an entity from entity could email out this, they could open the petition sheet online, right? And they can put their electronic signature on there, which is their signature that is on file with you, on that form and send it to somebody else to print and bring in. I believe that's probably transpiring right now, isn't it?
I assume you're wanting a real ink signature.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I'm not sure. I don't think that I've seen that, in practice. But, you know, that's something that we may want to look at. And
if the signature matches what's on file.
That's all we're looking at.
That's all you're looking at. I do see that. I thank somebody. This is the full informant from an international paper in my district here. We're going to print all these copies out, but I'm just not a good idea at this point.
Kimberly, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, Chair Burdick, Senator Boquist, and members of the committee, I just wanted to point out that I do think that there are some instances where you would be able to discover that a circulator or a person that was essentially acting as a circulator had printed out a bunch of these sheets, was getting people to sign them and turning them in. I mean, one example would be if they were sending them in bulk, right? So that the elections division received a whole bunch of them at one time. And there's also folks that do sort of watchdog type activity around these kinds of things. So if they saw somebody on the street or at the, you know, at the grocery store collecting signatures, and they were doing it with these e-sheets as opposed to a multi-signature sheet, I think those are examples when something like this could actually be discoverable.
What's the difference between that and inserting it in a magazine?
I think the key is that, or Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the key is that when people are gathering signatures, and particularly when they're getting paid to gather signatures, they may, in some instances, engage in fraudulent activity. I mean, that has happened in the past, right? So signature gatherers in particular, I mean, I think it has been a problem in the past when folks were getting paid per signature, which fortunately we have resolved that issue. But I think it still is a concern where people were putting down fake signatures, fake information. And so when they hand in the sheet that has 10 signatures on it and they've certified it, that allows the election division to see, oh, this person is engaging in some sort of fraudulent activity, and then they can follow up. So if they printed out 10 sheets instead of 10 of these e-sheets instead of a sheet with a whole bunch of signatures on it, essentially did the same thing and turned them in, because they're not certifying them, there would be no way for you to actually, for the elections division to be able to identify that person. So that's sort of the key here, is that the e-sheet is something that an individual should do themselves, and the multi-sheets is something that a circulator certifies so that you know who to hold accountable if there's some fraud. So,
but if we allow electronic signatures sheets now, how would a county clerk or the secretary of state ever know?
And we're encouraging this throughout the entire legislation. I mean, I keep railing at you guys' bills on the floor that we're doing this, so I don't understand why we're going back to the 16th century here.
Really?
In elections. I'm a little puzzled.
I'm with you.
Well, let me ask you this. What other methods would, because it really is, I mean, I've done a petition and there was fraud in my petition gathering. And not by me. By someone else.
Did we quote you?
Someone else got hold of my petitions, and it was a popular petition, and they were using it as a loss leader to get people to sign their petitions. And so I'm very aware of the potential for fraud in this process. And what Kimberly said about the accountability that certifiers have, I think is important. I mean, if you had a paid petitioner circulating these single sheets and, you know, turning in a bundle of them, it would be harder to hold somebody accountable. Is there another way to deal with that?
Well, Madam Chair, I think one of the issues here is paid circulators versus volunteer circulators.
Yeah.
You could address the bill in a manner in which, you know, paid petitioners can't do this and the common citizen on the street can do this.
Because currently we have different rules even for the 10 signature sheets, whether you're a volunteer circulator or whether you're a paid circulator. And so that may be a way to find some middle ground here.
And given the fact that you can do these electronic things, it's sort of like, why would you ever pay circulators? If you have a list like OEA or Common Thank Cause you. Or Name Your Party that has a good list, it's much easier. Particularly electronically, you can print it out. You can use that and just send it out very easily. It's much simpler, and it doesn't cost you anything.
Have you not received all of the stuff in your boxes?
I have from one particular campaign that's near and dear to our heart.
And, you know, I'm just piggybacking on the good senator here.
I've been getting it in my state email box from state email addresses. I'm just pointing this out to you, that, you know.
In that electronic age.
So, all right. Madam Chair, I didn't answer the question earlier about the erasure to reprinting. Did we want to address that?
Yeah, please.
What do you do with dead people?
So I think this is actually something that that was discovered that was already in the statute when we were looking at the district election sections. And so, yes, there will be a significant cost to the counties to reprint this. One option, and it was one of the amendments or the suggestions I had, was instead of having this be the 50th day, if we move that back to say the 60th or 70th day, or really the 61st day is when the ballot gets certified, at that point we would know who's qualified for the ballot, and if we had it at that timeline, then it would allow us to remove those people that shouldn't
dead.
Be on there and would and would not require the counties to reprint as long as we did it by that 61st day, which would just be 11 extra days added on to the proposed amendment here in -7.
So you're not in favor of the old Chicago rule of why would you deny the right to vote just because a person's dead?
Madam Chair, I'll take that as a rhetorical question.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out, despite the best advice of Mr. Trout, we previously in this committee, at the request of the county clerks, moved the 61st day, I think, back to the 70th day so they would have time to do the preparatory work before they did the printing. So I don't know whether 61st day is the right day or not. I'm just pointing out that we previously agreed with county clerks and changed some other election law for printing or doing something to the 70th day so that they have time to do the layup, setup, and all that stuff. I'm fine with 61 days. I'm just pointing out the inconsistencies of our own actions.
Your comments on that?
So, Madam Chair, there's different timelines, you know, throughout the election, but I think the 61st day is when everything is locked down as far as which candidates are going to be printed on the ballot so that the counties can get those prepared for the military and overseas voters, that those ballots have to go out on the 45th day before the election, which through the wisdom of Congress always lands on a Saturday, and so really in effect that's the 46th day that we get those out. And so having that time, there are some ballot layout questions and signature verification questions for candidates and for voters pamphlet filing in lieu of that happen on the 70th day, but as far as printing, I think the 61st day would be able to make sure that the counties wouldn't have to reprint any ballots if one of these if a candidate died or ended up not being qualified.
I'm fine. I'm just saying, ma'am.
Yeah. I guess I was sitting thinking that you sure you don't want to check with your county clerks before. I think you're on the right track. I don't know if that's the right day.
So, Madam Chair,
I'm willing
Senator
to go with whatever you
absolutely.
Say.
Absolutely. It's whatever the county clerks need, but I'm confident that's the 61st day, but we can talk to them in the interim here and make sure that that's the best day that will help to cover the situation, because it would be a significant cost for them.
We have a little time, but not much.
Right.
Okay, other questions from the committee, other issues that people wanted to question our panel?
That's good. Mm.
I used to ask in the Army, why is the sky blue, ma'am? That's a precious look. That's a precious look.
He gets that look a lot from me. It's like, huh?
That's better than push-ups.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, committee, we will take this all under advisement. I will be consulting with all the appropriate deities, and we are adjourned.
You're the deity.
That's right.